inspiring interviews with today's top landlords. This is the Rental Income Podcast. And now, Dan Lane.
If you're not familiar with the term house hacking, what it means is when you buy a property that you live in, but you also rent the property out. So to give you an example, you could do this with a duplex or a fourplex where you live in one of the units and you rent the other units out. Or you could do this with a single family house where you live in one of the bedrooms and then you rent the other rooms out to roommates. I think this is a great way to get started. It's what I did. My very first property was a single family house. I rented out two bedrooms to roommates and their rent covered my mortgage. And it really worked out great. And it really got me set on the path to become a real estate investor. So I definitely think that this is something that everybody should at least think about doing. My guest today has an awesome house hacking story. He lives in a really expensive market in Los Angeles, and he is making between $1,700 and $1,800 a month after he pays his mortgage and all of his expenses. So I'm really excited to hear his story. Let's take a real quick break. We'll come back in 30 seconds and we'll meet Wilson Lee.
Are you looking for a roadmap to financial freedom? If so, we have a solution for you. Narada Real Estate is offering a limited number of free strategy sessions to help you get out of the rat race. Learn how you can create wealth and build monthly passive income. To set up a time with one of our knowledgeable investment counselors, simply go to naradarealestate.com. That's NORADA realestate.com.
A lot of people tell me that they can't buy rentals where they live because the prices are too high or the numbers just don't work. I love that last week we had someone on the podcast from LA, and this week we have another guest on from LA. They've got two completely different strategies, and they're both making it work, and they're both doing really well. Wilson, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I'm excited to hear your story. So why don't we start at the very beginning? So what got you first interested in investing in real estate?
Well, I always knew that it was important to have multiple streams of income. And I also knew that real estate is something that's really feasible and something that can be done ultimately if you're creative and if you're smart and if you're resourceful. So it was curiosity that stemmed all of it. And then from there, I started to do a lot of homework. And I read all the books that your guests have talked about, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Bigger Pockets is a big thing. And I just scoured the internet, talked to as many people as I could. And so I came to this fork in the road where I was trying to figure out, okay, well, I finally have enough funds to really make a move. But do I buy a house to live in? Or do I do something for my future and buy an investment? And I wanted both to be completely frank. And so I thought, you know what? The only way I'm really going to make this work is if I house hack. And so that was the route that I started to take. How do I make this happen?
And as far as just buying a regular rental, it's just tough to do where you live, right? Like you just can't make the numbers work on a house unless you're going to also live there.
100%. Yeah. You know, what's common is like that 1% rule, right? And if you try to apply that here in LA, you're going to realize very, very quickly that that does not work at all.
Right. So did you look around at all, or did it just take you a few minutes of looking at listings to realize it's just not going to happen?
It was the former, and it was a very painful experience.
Really? Tell me about it. So did you have a realtor? Like, did you go out and actually look at properties?
Yeah, that's exactly how it started. So I have a friend who is a realtor, and so I went with a single family home purchase, but I was actually, when I intended, I was looking for multifamily. I wanted to live in one unit and then rent out the others. Mm-hmm. But again, those numbers really don't work.
Yeah. You know,
I was either being priced out, it was a little too expensive for me, or there were just bigger players in the market who were able to purchase all cash,
right?
Or just better deals that I was able to offer. And so, after about a year of looking, I think I looked at maybe 30 potential properties, putting in bids, coming up short, you know, getting other people's bids picked over mine. At that moment, I realized, okay, I need to change my strategy a little bit. And so that's when I started thinking, okay, maybe I can find a single family home And I just got accepted into school. So I was speaking to friends who also went to the same school, and they said, hey, you know, we're paying this much for rent when I went to school, or, you know, before I graduated. And that's when it kind of clicked, like, hey, well, you know, as long as a university is there, there's always going to be a need for temporary living. Right. And parents are always willing to support their children for higher education. And so I thought that was going to be a really good opportunity for me. And so I kind of went with it. I ended up finding a 4-bedroom, 2-bath home with a detached garage that was converted. And so I lived in one, and then all the other ones were rent to students.
Okay. Now, what about trying to figure out what the rooms would rent for? Tell me about how you did your research on that.
Yeah, so it was a little bit of trial and error, and it was, again, a lot of homework. So I currently go to USC, and I have friends that are either also attending or used to attend but graduated. And I started by asking them, like, you know, what did you guys pay? And I would ask them, where were they living relative to school? You know, how far of a distance it was. And as you can imagine, the closer you are to school, the more expensive it is. Mm-hmm. The further you are to school, the cheaper it is. And so I used that as sort of a gauge as to where to start. And I didn't know what the exact number was, but I knew that if I just sort of started on the little higher range of what I thought was fair, and then just slowly worked my way down based on the feedback of the market, I was able to find, I guess, like an ideal price point for myself.
Okay.
And that's kind of how that went down. A lot of trial and error, a lot of homework.
Now, so what about timing-wise? Because I guess people are looking for a place at – they want to move into a place when the semester is starting. So was that important to close on the place maybe around August, or how did that kind of work out in your head as you were planning this whole purchase out?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And the short answer is that I think it's really vital for me for this property specifically. Mainly because I knew that the best way for me to maintain the highest probability of tenants and minimize my vacancies is that I wanted to keep annual lease agreements consistent with the turn of the school year. So school starts in August and ends in, you know, roughly about July of next year. So that was the agreement that I set into my leases with my tenants, is that, you know, you come in August 1st, you do your school for that year. Hopefully you stay until you graduate. But even if you do decide to leave after that first year, the influx of students coming in next year, or students looking for places to stay, it would minimize that gap. And if there was, you know, maybe a week of churn or whatever, I would just ultimately eat that cost, you know, prorate the rent, whatever I had to. But it was the best strategy for me to make sure that there's always somebody there.
Now, what about screening tenants? Because it's pretty easy to screen a tenant when you're doing a traditional rental. You make sure that their income is enough to afford the property. But when you're renting to students, like, it's not as simple, is it? I mean, that they don't have jobs, maybe, or like, how did you kind of screen your tenants?
So, yeah, again, super important, super valuable. But I think I was fortunate in the sense that, you know, students usually have the support of their family. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is, you know, traditionally you do a background check, proof of income, so on and so forth. But what I actually did was I made the extra effort to connect with my tenants' families. And ideally, when they would come view the property, that there would be a family member with them, or whoever okay. their financial support was. And I would make sure that their situation checked out and that it was okay with them, that they understood this is what's going to happen, this is the agreement, that they would be able to support their son or daughter in this whole situation. Okay. I also have another student who is a PhD student, and he gets a stipend from school. And so not only is he doing his PhD, but he's also, I guess, working for school, and he gets an X amount of money every single month for it. And he showed me that stipend and that letter to prove that, like, I'm going to be able to have sufficient income to be able
right.
to pay.
Okay. Monthly.
Coming up on the Rental Income Podcast.
I want to go over some of the numbers, and I also want to see what it's like to take 5 people that are complete strangers and put them together and not have them cause a lot of drama for Wilson. But first, I want to thank Realty Shares for making this episode possible.
Not an offering of securities. Private investments are highly illiquid and risky and are not suitable for all investors. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Securities offered to accredited investors through North Capital Private Securities. Member FINRA SIPC.
It can be a lot of work trying to generate passive income. You've got to find the right deals. You've got to vet the deals, do inspections, line up financing. There's a ton of moving parts. But if you're looking to generate passive income with really no work on your side, Realty Shares is definitely something you should check out. That's Realty Shares, spelled R-E-A-L-T-Y, shares, realtyshares.com. The way Realty Shares works is it's a crowdfunding site for real estate investors. So they're out there, they're trying to find the right deals, they're vetting deals, making sure that they're good, solid investments. When something meets their really strict criteria, they put the information on their website with pictures of the project. They have detailed due diligence you can read. Information about the management team is on there. If something makes sense to you, you can invest right there from your phone or your computer. You can invest as little as $5,000, and then you're done. The passive income just starts showing up in your account. Now, of course, there's always risk with any investment, but I think Realty Shares is a great way to diversify your portfolio and diversify your passive income streams. They have a special offer just for our listeners. If you go to realtyshares.com/rental, that's realtyshares, R-E-A-L-T-Y, shares.com/rental, you can get $100 towards your first investment. That's realtyshares.com/rental for $100 towards your first investment. All right, let's get back to the show. So Wilson, tell me about your property some more. I want to go over some of the numbers. What did you pay for this property and what are the rooms rented out for?
I closed at 540. I put 20% down. And so as I mentioned before, it's five bedrooms. Four bedrooms, I'm getting 975 each. And the master, which has its own bathroom and obviously a little bigger, I'm getting 1400.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's how much? About 50 or 5,000, somewhere around there?
About 5,300 and like a little bit. Okay. Yeah, something like
that. Now, if you just rented that house out to a regular family, what do you think that would rent out for?
Definitely not close to what I'm getting. I think I would get somewhere in the 4,000 range.
Okay. Like so you're making a lot of extra money by putting in a little bit of work. Yeah. Now, you were living in the house initially, but now you've moved out, right?
Yeah, correct. When I first moved it, well, when I first got the place, I was living there. But my girlfriend kind of wants her own little privacy. So mm-hmm. we decided to get our own place and we rent a studio.
Okay. Now, tell me about managing the property, because when you're living there, I imagine it's a lot easier to manage the day-to-day stuff in the house. But when you moved out, was it a lot harder to manage everything and to make sure things were going right at the house?
It's definitely a lot easier to keep an eye on things in the house, and it's a lot easier to kind of like fix things right away, just because you see it immediately, you address it immediately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
From a distance, I don't want to say it's harder. I really don't think it is harder, but I think it's important to make sure that you have a system or that you have a point of contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the tenants is that person for me. It's not official. There's nothing like, you know, in writing, but whenever there is a need or a concern within the house, it's usually raised to this individual. And then I have that conversation with the individual.
Okay.
Like, hey, I'm going to come by and pick up rent, or, you know, cleaning's going to stop by later on this weekend to make sure everybody's aware. But that said, you know, I always ensure that communication is open with everybody and that everyone has my contact and they're always free to reach out to me for any reason. I think, you know, that transparency is super important.
You mentioned cleaning. So do you have a maid service that comes on a regular schedule?
Yeah, I do. So it's set up to be the first Saturday of every month.
Okay.
And when I was there, it was pretty good. You know, I ask all the other tenants if, you know, just take care of your own space and let's work together to keep the communal space clean. But I guess people became a little more laxed when I moved out, and I sort of noticed that in the environment. Mm-hmm. So I kind of brought that up with everybody, and I felt like, hey, you know, what do you guys think if we have the cleaning service come twice a month, biweekly? And they all thought that it was a really good idea. And so the way that it's kind of worked out is that the first Saturday of the month, I actually have that built in into their monthly rent. So they don't pay for anything on that on the first time. And then on the second iteration, we agreed that I would pay 25% and the house would pay 75%. Okay. And it's worked out well.
How do you actually collect that? Like, are you paying the maid 25%? Like, I guess, is everybody just leaving a check for their portion of it? Or do you pay the maid and just bill your tenants?
I pay the maid first.
Okay.
And then it's either like tacked on, or, you know, if something happens and like one of the tenants need to pay for me first, we just subtract it from the rent.
Okay.
And that's the whole like transparency and like communication. As long as, you know, we're having that dialogue, I'm usually pretty flexible.
Right. How do you handle utilities?
And this goes back into, I guess, the business model of how I wanted to set the place up. Because I knew that it was primarily going to be for students, I wanted to make it as easy for them as possible. Mm-hmm. I remember back when I was an undergrad, I chopped up all my utilities with my friends that lived in the house. You know, like, you pay this much, you know, we divide mm-hmm. it equally, whatever. But that gets complicated.
Right.
So what I decided to do off the bat was that it's going to be a flat rate. This is what I'm asking for, and all of this is going to be included. And if there are any fluctuations or, you know, standard deviations, if you may, of expenses, me as the landlord and as the owner, I was just going to eat that cost.
Okay.
And I felt like it's worked out really well. You know, that tenants really appreciate the fact that they don't have to worry about all these things, like, you know, water, gas, internet, so on and so forth. And it's been smooth. You know, mm-hmm. Can't complain.
Now, what about just keeping, because you've got five random people living in this house. And I know just from living with roommates when I was younger, it can be hard sometimes to get along with people that you're friends with. But when you have five people that you've just kind of brought together, is there any, or has there been any personality conflicts or just drama that you've had to get in the middle of?
So I wouldn't call it drama, but whenever you're in a, I guess, a like confined space, if you may, mm-hmm. with a bunch of different people, there's always going to be a little bit of, you know, disagreement, misunderstanding, whatever. Right.
Right.
And so for me, what was really important was it was actually the screening process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm definitely as objective and as fair as I can be with the way I did this. But one thing that really mattered to me was, like you were saying, personalities and how I thought people were going to be able to get along. Now, obviously, I was making a lot of assumptions on these things, but I felt that if I picked the right people with the right personalities, it would be as harmonious as possible.
Right.
But, you know, inevitably, things were always going to arise. And so I always set these expectations up front with all the tenants that, you know, communication. And it's communication with me, communication with each other. But ultimately, as long as there's dialogue going on in the house and you guys are all mutually respectful of each other, and to know that, you know, no one is trying to take advantage of each other, or that no one is, you know, for example, purposefully trying to hog the laundry machine or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that things would be okay. And so I think the point for me there was that to really set those expectations up front, like, hey, this is what I expect. This is what I want from the house. This is what I'm hoping you guys are going to be able to do, and how you guys will help maintain the quality of the house for everyone to enjoy. And hopefully that would be a win-win situation. And whenever things actually did come up, like, for example, we have an automated gate for the lot so that cars can come and park in the driveway. There were a few nights where it was just left open. And people would reach out to me and be like, hey, this has been happening. So whenever I heard about stuff like this, or whenever I felt like, oh, if I don't take care of this now, it might become a really big problem later. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just kind of being proactive about it is I would address it immediately. Like, hey, guys, you know, not pointing any fingers. Notice this has been happening. Please make sure that you guys are aware and address this because of safety, because of everyone else in the house, so on and so forth. And okay. I've noticed that people have been really receptive to that. As long as I, you know, communicate, treat them like normal human beings, get beyond the fact that they're tenants and I'm the landlord,
right.
You know, make that relationship a little more personable, if you may. People are really receptive and they understand, as long as I'm reasonable and logical and respectful.
So it seems like this is really working out awesome for you. Do you want to keep doing it? Like, would you do another one of these house hacks?
I think now that I know that I've made it work after trial and error, I think that this is going to be something that's going to be part of my investment real estate strategy as long as it can be. As long as I'm in this game, it's always going to be something that I'm going to be looking forward to. It's not necessarily USC, but just like any university.
Yeah, I think student housing is a great niche. I think there's always going to be a need for good housing close to a university. Well, if you want to reach out to Wilson, I've got his email address on the website. You can find it at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode131. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back with a new episode next Tuesday. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.